You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor. And today, if you're a follower on Facebook, you might have seen I was planning a Halloween special. Life happened, and that is not happening. But I have something equally scary to talk about. So that's exciting, I guess. There's no shortage of spooky topics going on in the world right now. So I am here with Kate Bitz, who agreed to meet with me at the last minute. And we're going to talk a little bit about white nationalism as it relates in the U.S. and around the world. It's been kind of a rough week in those terms, both with the shooting at Tree of Life Synagogue on Saturday, with the bombs that were sent here in the U.S., with the election of Bolsonaro in Brazil, etc. So, hi.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Can you just introduce yourself, talk a little bit about who you are and the work that you do?
Yeah. So I'm Kate Bitz. I'm lucky enough right now to be part of the first class of senior fellows in the Defending Democracy at Western program at Western State Center out of Portland. The Defending Democracy program is all about building inclusive community and countering white nationalism. So what that means is that having gotten into this type of activism in, I guess you would say, more of a subcultural way through neighborhood activism while living in Hamburg and Berlin, Germany, I am now in a position where I get to learn from experts, do a little bit of my own projects, and be affiliated with a wonderful organization that's been doing this work for a very long time.
Cool. And I'll just add that I think Western State Center online has a lot of good kind of further resources for folks who are interested in this.
Absolutely. And I didn't come prepared with a list of sources, but I would say we can easily put that up with the podcast transcript for people who are interested in learning more about this in a focused way.
Awesome. Yeah. I have no doubt in your research thoroughness.
Just tell me how many links before is too many links, yeah, and then I'll give you that many.
Okay. Great. So about a month ago, I had Dr. Joan Braun on, and she and I talked about fascism. So I thought we could start by kind of clarifying the Venn diagram that is fascism as a whole and white nationalism.
Right. Absolutely. So one thing that I will say is that groups like this always seek to define themselves in ways that are not going to sound threatening. So the second that we in the wider society and in the wider discussion think of fascism as something unattractive or of white nationalism as something threatening, they will find other ways to talk about themselves. Fascism also is something that expresses itself in a certain way around violence for violence's sake, which I know you probably remember from discussing with Joan, violence as an end in itself. And what that means is that groups that are not necessarily white nationalist, like, for example, the Proud Boys, where people have been very confused to see men of color involved, groups like that can still definitely express they can express themselves in a fascist way and they can have a fascist ideology. White nationalism is something a little bit more specific, and it's something that makes the most sense to talk about in a United States context because of the way that we define whiteness. Not every country defines that the same. We have a very specific history of whiteness in this country. And white nationalism does have a specific aim when we talk about whiteness. They want to make the United States into a white ethnostate. They see the United States as territory that was taken for white people, by white people, by right, essentially. They think that it was just conquest to take this land away from its rightful owners, the indigenous people, in our case, mm-hmm, the Spokane tribe. Mm-hmm. They often also are bound up in a very normative framework of whiteness as Christianity, patriarchy, heteronormativity, cis normativity. So we do talk about these groups as white nationalist groups because their main political aims have to do with, as Patrick Casey of Identity Europa got the chance to say on the Today Show a few weeks ago, astoundingly, mm-hmm. maintaining a white supermajority. However, what we see from them in terms of harassment and bad behavior often also hits at folks who are women, feminist women, queer folks, mm-hmm. trans folks. So that's important to understand as well. Just because some of us are white doesn't mean that they're for us. If we don't fit their normative vision of what whiteness is meant to be, they'll eventually come for us too. Another important thing to mention about white nationalism is that their aim of creating a white ethnostate. Right now, a lot of these groups will still kind of pretend that this is something you can achieve by restricting immigration. You can't. And in order to achieve what they want to achieve, what you're eventually talking about is the repression, dispossession, and either forcible expulsion or genocide of people of color. Mm-hmm. So as we see these groups normalizing themselves and really giving propagandistic concepts of how they could achieve their aims, let's just keep that in the back of our minds, that their ultimate aim is not achievable without genocide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wouldn't take much number crunching to do, I feel like, to take out all those groups you named, take out people of color, indigenous people, Jewish people,
yes.
women who aren't down with the patriarchy, queer folks who are white and aren't in those other categories, they're certainly a minority. And to achieve a supermajority, that's not it's a pretty bleak program that they have going on. And
definitely.
I'm glad you mentioned that appearance on the Today Show. I touched on that a little bit when I talked with Joan about this idea that people seem to have right now in journalism and in society at large, that everyone deserves a platform and that this is a free speech issue. Can you? I didn't believe that that had happened on the Today Show until I saw it. So,
yeah, it's I think this essentially happens, and again, I definitely refer to that discussion with Joan for a more detailed analysis of all that. But what is key to keep in mind with all of this is that these folks are propagandists. And what exactly that means? That means that they can't effectively organize for their true aims unless they conceal them. And it means that a good reason to not give them a platform is that you're not getting an honest interview from them. I mean, I will sit here and I'll tell you exactly what I think of these groups and exactly how I think it's expedient to organize against them. I don't have a hidden agenda.
Mm-hmm.
They, on the other hand, if they are transparent about their aims are extremely unpopular, and they would lose those platforms that they have and lose their popular support if folks knew what they were after.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. That is one reason why I think it does not make sense to give that type of platform, at least without some really extremely deep research beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I kind of want to double back to what you were saying in your introduction about what white nationalism is kind of as a project. And it sounds to me that it's like a continuation of this like manifest destiny idea, right? That in democratic society, small d democratic society, we've been trying to expand, for better or for worse, expanding these rights to more groups. They're kind of wanting to keep with this original vision.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is a key thing to understand about white nationalism, that they do have a past in this country to hearken back to. So while we often talk about the American idea and talk about ourselves as a democratic country, small d democratic, that's a specific thing that that groups like women and like people of color have been able to win for ourselves through social movements from the left. We can partly understand white nationalist groups as social movements from the right who are attempting to take us backwards to a more restrictive version of what American democracy is. And at the beginning, I mean, we should say it was highly restrictive. White male landowners could vote. Black people were mostly enslaved. The original owners of this land had no path to power or land ownership. It's a vision with a precedent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, so from that time when, you know, that was all overt in the law, what is that like tracking closer into the future? Like, what are some important touchstones between, you know, the Revolutionary War and now, maybe particularly in this region?
Yeah, that's a great question. One thing that's very important to think about when we talk about the Western states, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, is that these states were originally built upon the genocide of indigenous people and the theft of their land. And they also had very restrictive settlement policies when it came to people of color. So until a guy who was actually named George W. Bush, a black man who established a farm, I know, right? Isn't that such a fun piece of trivia?
The other George W.
Yes.
Bush.
The good George W. Bush. Before he established a homestead and had to fight in court to be able to keep his land as a black landowner near Seattle, there were really no black settlers in the Pacific Northwest. So we have this background of our states having these restrictive settlement policies. And of course, until 1965, immigration was restricted by race in this country. Well, from the 1920s to 1965. So essentially, we have a really obvious structural vulnerability to white nationalism in this area.
Mm-hmm.
There's a recent geography paper that shows us kind of the areas of the country that have a disproportionate amount of hate groups in them. Ours is one of them. And there are four factors that that can explain this disparity. So one, as we were just talking about, is lack of diversity.
Racially.
Yes. And overall, mm-hmm. but especially racially. Another one is in terms of race, a lack of population change. So not only an initial lack of diversity, but just a lack of new folks moving in from other places in the world and with different backgrounds, which makes it so that people around here simply don't have a lot of personal experience with what it's like when immigration changes your town. And that produces fears that are very hard to allay through personal experience. The other two factors are high poverty, which, of course, is such a big factor in the Spokane area.
Mm-hmm.
We have such enormous disparities in our town that between the richest and the poorest Spokane neighborhoods, we actually have a life expectancy disparity of 17 years. The difference between how long you may live as someone who lives on the South Hill versus if you live downtown or on the North Side is a larger difference than between many what we call first world and third world countries.
Mm-hmm.
So we obviously have this poverty issue. And another factor that makes us vulnerable is low educational attainment. Because similar to low diversity and low population change, if we don't have an understanding of how the world works, that makes us more vulnerable to kind of this white nationalist appeal.
Mm.
And of course, it's not like academics are the only ones who noticed this. Over time, white nationalists themselves noticed this, and they targeted our region for settlement. So I feel like I've been talking for a long time, but I guess that's where we get into the 1970s and the Northwest Territorial Imperative, which was an agreement made by a number of white power groups, including, of course, the Aryan Nations, that they would take this area, which has such a potential from their point of view, to become a white nationalist homeland and turn it into a white ethnostate. This was a plan, and it was in part carried out with various waves of intentional settlement through white nationalists, beginning in the 1970s, especially going up through the 90s because of the prevalence of the Aryan Nations, the Christian Identity Churches, other white nationalist groups, and in fact, going into the 2000s. So this is just something that is part, at this point, it's part of the DNA of our area, and it's something that has been with us for a long time.
Yeah, and it seems like we're, you know a lot more detail about this than I do, but it seems like we're in the midst of another wave now in recent years. Is that true? I mean, you hear people like that guy, his last name, Little, in Sandpoint, saying on his terrible anti-Semitic robocalls that this area, specifically North Idaho, is one of the last great freedom-loving parts of the country. There's this kind of coded speak. I know some prominent people have been looking at this area again. Is it an again, or is it just a continuous line kind of from the 70s?
It may be both. Okay. So there are probably people left over from other groups that ended up disbanding and are just kind of still here. Harpum, who attempted to bomb the 2011 MLK Day Unity Parade, is one of those folks who had longtime affiliations, but who had kind of gone dormant for a very long time until he decided to make that attempt. At the same time, there are new groups nationwide, and this time it's actually different from the 1990s in that there is a nationwide explosion of these groups. So while we are seeing those effects here at home, coastal cities are also seeing them, and many regions that haven't traditionally played host to very many hate groups are probably seeing chapters of groups like Identity Europa, which was only founded in 2016, popping up in their areas.
And you mentioned those last two indicators that you talked about, the disproportionality around poverty and educational attainment, coupled with what you said about white nationalism as a social movement from the right. I can see how macro level kind of right wing policy ensures that those conditions stay in place, you know, like strengthening capitalism through corporate welfare, you know, attacking higher ed and public support for higher ed. Is that just an unfortunate coincidence, or?
Without wanting to get in, I think it's very easy once you learn about this subject to start seeing white nationalism behind every capitalist or every conservative movement or personality. So I want to warn away from that. Don't look at education cuts and say, oh my God, it's white nationalists trying to create a larger base.
Yeah.
It probably is not.
That's probably just an unfortunate side effect.
Right.
Yes.
That said, however, there is, I mean, the reason why I personally counter white nationalism is not because I love going to rallies and holding up a sign with a rainbow heart that says love on it and crying. The problem here is not that hate groups are mean. The problem is that they are trying to gain access to power, and they have been successful in that in some ways. So, for example, when you look at our current immigration policy and how that has shifted, there's a lot of groups like with these very neutral names, like the Center for Immigration Studies or Respect Washington, which actually attempted to run an anti-immigrant initiative here in Spokane. These groups are part of the less obvious, more intellectual, more suit and tie side of the white nationalist movement. They're connected to the Tanton Network, which is a longtime network of anti-immigrant think tanks and lobbying shops, which gets all of its money originally from a fortune that was left to people who were in the American eugenics movement in the 1920s. And that is a movement that was very explicitly the inspiration for many of the race policies of Nazi Germany. So this movement is old. It has deep roots. It has, in some parts of the movement, deep pockets. And it does, you know, it has its successes in the policy sphere. Folks like Chris Kobach, who was involved in trying to get the question about immigration status and citizenship onto the 2020 census, speak at conferences that these folks put on, Kobach also recently was exposed by Republican consultants for having Identity Europa members in his Kansas governor's race campaign. Yep.
Wow.
And that is a close race. He could easily become governor of Kansas. These are all people who do have these affiliations. If people are more interested in learning how to spot those red flags without kind of seeing white nationalists behind every corner, I think they would do well to take a look at the reading list that we'll put up, because, again, this is not a reason to point at all Republicans and scream Nazi or scream white nationalists. That is not effective. It's not helpful. It's time to sharpen and deepen our analysis if we're going to do something about this beyond using it as a way to do name calling, mm-hmm. essentially.
Yeah. And to get specific, because otherwise it loses all its potency.
Absolutely.
Like the GOP office, they're in New York City, did host that talk by the Proud Boys that was followed by street violence.
Yes.
Them. There's a specific, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, and the more specific you are in understanding who is affiliated with whom, the more specific you can get in your activism, the more you can figure out who is worth looking further into, who you should be specifically trying to counter and marginalize. Because many conservatives are not in agreement with this entire strain of white nationalism. And one of the best things that we can do is help conservatives marginalize and exclude people like this from their own movements and draw those boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis. I'm talking with Kate Bitz. She's a senior fellow in the Defending Democracy program at Western States Center. Nailed it. And we are talking about white nationalism. And so you talked just now about this kind of through line from the eugenics movement in the 20s, inspiring Nazi Germany. And there's other, I believe that the system of reservations and Jim Crow were also influences on Hitler's thinking and other Nazis' thinking around this. So I guess I'm curious about, and you also said white nationalism is kind of the specifically American phenomenon in some ways. But I'm wondering if you want to speak a little bit to your experience in Europe and in Germany with the far right and kind of this broader rise of the far right and how this puzzle all fits together.
Yeah, I think that is so important. If we are going to be effective in moving policy as a set of left social movements and finding effective counters to this, you know, very alarming, very sudden, and recently very violent rise of white nationalism at home and various forms of ultranationalism and fascism abroad, we have to think in an internationalist way, because they do too. As far as what I learned from being in Germany, I guess I always tell people I've never lived anywhere that didn't have some type of Nazi problem. So I grew up in the suburbs of Spokane. My family, you know, we had our experiences with going up to Sandpoint, seeing people with white power tattoos. I essentially grew up going to the counter rallies against the Aryan Nations. And then when I was 19, it was 2004, and it seemed to me like a good time to maybe leave the United States forever.
I remember 2004. Yes. Yeah, it did feel that way.
I'm sure those of you who remember 2004, you remember this. If not, I guess ask your elders, because now we are elders. I ended up moving to Hamburg, which is a beautiful city. And if there's one place in Germany you should visit, it's definitely Hamburg. Still love it. Hamburg, meine Perle. anyway, it's not a place that I would call a center of right-wing organizing. And in fact, most of the activism I was doing was in a neighborhood context. We were putting on street festivals. We started a membership food co-op in my neighborhood. Did cleanups, planted flowers. But because it's Germany, and because they do have a long-running problem, of course, with right-wing extremism and neo-Nazism, the first time that somebody looked at me about a year into my stay there and said, you know, oh, there's going to be a Nazi march through town, come help us block it, I said, of course. right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as one should. Yes.
it's what I've been doing my whole life. I think one of the major lessons that I learned over there is the ways in which these movements are always warping and evolving to fit the times. So, for example, I guess we're learning this with groups like Identity Europa or people like Richard Spencer, who are known for dressing like businessmen and therefore, you know, fascinating and charming New York Times reporters. They're always changing their presentation to fit a kind of subcultural ideal that is constantly shifting. So, for example, in 2008, there was a big Nazi march in Hamburg. It was through Barmbek, which is a working class and heavily immigrant neighborhood, which they were targeting on purpose, you know, on May 1st, which is a very left-identified holiday in Germany. It's the workers' day. Mm-hmm. They were targeting this on purpose to make people uncomfortable and to try and make a show of dominance. It was essentially a way of invading territory that they saw as being leftist. And fascists are always very obsessed with territory and borders. Mm-hmm. So this is one way to read a lot of what they do, is to take a look at how are they territorializing their movement. This was the first time that we saw a group come out in force called the Autonome Nationalen, which is called it's like the National Autonomous. And this was a Nazi black bloc. They showed up looking exactly like anarchists do in that part of the world. You know, black hat, mm-hmm. black face covering,
bandana,
mm-hmm. black jacket. They also marched with banners that said things like save the workers and globalization. So you could see them, you know, explicitly kind of stealing and co-opting leftist messaging in order to confuse people and in order to blur the line and also in order to make themselves feel cool. One of the advantages that the left always has is kind of this dominance over culture and style. Mm-hmm. And so you often see them taking from us what they can't really invent themselves. So that's one thing, is just watching them grow and change. And I actually think it was around 2010 that I started to notice that their movement was growing quite international and that there were these connections. Like, for example, I read about David Duke making trips to Ukraine. And at first I thought, well, that's hilarious. You know, clearly he's going broke in the United States. So now he's going abroad to make, you know, one final attempt to hawk his books in another country and context that doesn't already reject him. But then I noticed that, do you remember the Ground Zero Mosque issue, so-called?
Yes.
Yes.
I do.
So there's a woman named Pamela Geller, who's very, very Islamophobic, who was kind of spearheading this whole movement to stop an Islamic community center from being built a couple blocks away from the site of the World Trade Center in Manhattan. And she invited a Dutch politician called Geert Wilders to come and speak at that. And Wilders was, or still is, the head of the Dutch far-right party.
Hmm.
And he was there to talk about the Islamicization of Europe. Like the fact that there are neighborhoods that are predominantly Muslim in European cities, which, by the way, I've lived in those neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
They are not what people on the right in America or in Europe say that they are. But it was very easy for American conservatives to pick up this messaging and to pick up what I would call kind of a primal fear of invasion and displacement,
mm-hmm.
And become quite obsessed with this. It was only a few months after that appearance by Wilders that I started getting emails from my right-wing relatives worrying about my safety in my neighborhood St. Georg in Hamburg because of the Islamicization of Europe.
Wow. And that's so, that dialogue is so toxic because of the distance, because as mm-hmm. you were saying, you know, it's not, people who are most susceptible to this messaging are very much not doing that international travel. And that's not to sound classist and to say in order to have awareness, you need to travel, because I don't believe that's true.
Right.
But you do need to have some level of exposure in thought and experience to other people in real life.
Yeah. And it's, if I'm talking about the folks who tend to really be entrenched in this belief system now in America, it's definitely people who don't necessarily know a lot of Muslims or a mm-hmm. lot of immigrants overall, and don't have very much experience with all of that. And the dialogue only got more toxic from there, really. I don't know if you remember this, but it was kind of a key event in far-right radicalization, both in Europe and made an appearance on some, you know, white nationalist bellwethers in the United States, such as Breitbart and Donald Trump Jr.'s Twitter feed.
Not places I frequent, but go
yes.
on.
Well, some of us monitor them.
Yes.
So on New Year's Eve from 2015 to 2016 in Frankfurt, there was an incident where men, mostly of Moroccan descent, had decided that a great way to rob women of their pocketbooks was to come up and grope them. And then while they were trying to grasp what had happened to them, you know, the men could easily get away. And I should say in advance, Germany is a hard drinking culture. There are a lot of public events where people are drinking on the street. And my personal experience with these events is that they include sexual harassment, and that this is not a racialized dynamic mm-hmm. at all. Like, after this happened, I was telling people, yes, you know, in Hamburg, we're quite familiar with gangs of foreign men who go around pestering women. They're called bachelor parties that fly in from London.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No offense yeah. to any British people, but yes.
There, sure. It was, yes. There's men, men of all stripes yes. have been known to
exactly.
engage in such behavior.
And there's
behavior.
A certain type of tourism that mm-hmm. that can involve this.
Yeah.
And definitely the worst experiences I ever had with street harassment were from white German men. However, this was the one time that it was really scandalized because of the racial dynamics. It easily called up this fear of, you know, men of color attacking white women,
mm-hmm.
Regardless of whether all of the attackers were men of color. And I am certain that not all of the victims were white women.
Mm-hmm.
But it quickly led to this incredibly racist discourse in which all of a sudden newspapers that were as mainstream as the New York Times were putting graphics on their front page of, you know, a drawing of a black hand against a white background, you know, implying this racialized attack.
Mm-hmm.
And between that, all of the fear mongering around movements of Syrian refugees around that time, the Paris attacks, of course. It was quite astounding how quickly public opinion turned, and being someone who was kind of in the center of some of those places that were set up as supposed no-go zones, places that were, you know, supposedly being overrun with refugees, places that were suddenly supposedly zones of danger, I can tell you that it simply wasn't the reality on the ground. There was a lot of, you know, frankly, hysteria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then that narrative, we see that in the U.S. too, with the Mexican border, the
Absolutely.
U.S.-Mexico border, that's been, you know, that has been lent a warning, kind of a boogeyman of sexual violence with, you know, Donald Trump and his ilk saying that the people coming are rapists and murderers and
yep.
gang members. And again, that's appealing to this, you know, the fragility of quote unquote our women.
Yep.
Which I think you and I can say that we're not their women.
Right.
And aren't afraid of immigrants coming in. And I mean, you can see all of this kind of like learning back and forth, and it's old tricks too, like
it
you
is.
Said that are being rebranded
yes
over
I
and
was
over
just
again
that there was a guest on Fox News who was whipping up the idea that this migrant caravan might include people who have diseases like rabies or typhus. And when we look at that type of thing, that is a classic linkage between people of color, immigrants, and disease
mm-hmm.
that is very central to Nazi propaganda. and was in the 40s.
It is. That whole idea of the rats and the vermin terminology
absolutely.
Is definitely getting recycled.
Yeah. So wherever you see this idea of purity under fire, whether it's white women, whether it's our country as a whole, whether it's the idea of immigrants being a vector for disease, that should be an alarm bell for all of us. With that, I think it's, I don't know how much time we have left, but I think we should be speaking about the role of anti-Semitism in all of this.
Yes, I was, just about to. And actually, one final thought on language, mm-hmm. something I saw pointed out today, that the tweet, or it was on Gab, I guess, that the shooter in the mosque, what is his name? Bowers, said he referred to this invasion that had to be stopped and that he was going to go do it. That's a summation of what he said, but he used this invasion terminology. And 2 days later, Donald Trump echoed that same invasion terminology, talking about the quote unquote approaching caravan.
Yep.
So that is something we should pay attention to, you know, even though the president isn't exactly someone who's careful with language. I also don't think that he's fully accidental with language by any means. So
no, I don't think so. And even if all that an individual understands about using this language is that it really gets people going, it really whips people up. That is still based on the structures and the long running discourses of white nationalism. Someone does not have to be a white nationalist to echo white nationalist tropes and use them to build power.
Mm-hmm. So to anti-Semitism, I've just begun to understand the role of anti-Semitism in broader racism and white nationalism better, myself, because so much in American society, a lot of Jewish people are considered white some of the time, right? So
right.
Do you want to dive into kind of that role of how does anti-Semitism fit into
sure.
all of this?
Absolutely. And I just want to say up front that I'm going to be describing some very offensive ideas. So, you know, if that's not the right thing for you right now at this time when we have lost 11 Jewish people to an anti-Semitic attack, this would be a good time to tune out and maybe wait for the podcast when you're feeling a different way.
Yes.
Thank I don't endorse any of these ideas. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking about them because I think it's so important to talk explicitly about all mm-hmm. of this. All right. So that said, let's talk about the shift from structural de jure legal white supremacy in the United States to this white nationalist movement that is attempting to regain and build upon and make even worse structural white supremacy. I'm not saying that structural white supremacy is over. What I'm saying is that for white supremacists, the civil rights movement was a major shift. Before, they didn't just have de facto segregation. They had segregation that could be enforced by law. And all white life could be lived without a single intervention from the government by right. And that was something that a lot of folks took for granted and thought could not be challenged, not only because it was so long running, but because they didn't understand the capacity of people of color to create effective social movements, build solidarity with anti-racist white people, and win. The fact that the Civil Rights Act of 1965, or 1968, I believe, happened, the fact that segregation as a legal regime fell, was an immense shock to the system for so many people who simply thought black people in this country can never free themselves because they are not equal to white people in intellectual capacity, in organizing capacity, in the capacity to build that solidarity. And I think what they would have found out if they had used this for an opportunity to reflect and rethink their entire lives, which is always my wish for white nationalists, mm-hmm. please rethink your entire life. Mm-hmm. what they would have realized if they took it as that opportunity is that black people are equal to white people and that people of color do have the capacity to free themselves, and that in every way, people of color are equal to us as white people. But that would have absolutely shattered their sense of self, their sense of identity, their worldview. And so they settled on an alternate narrative in various degrees of explicitness, which is that Jewish people Jewish people do, for historical reasons, sit at a lot of at the center of a lot of spaces where we make culture in the United States. Many of the first Hollywood executives were Jewish. Many wonderful culture makers are Jewish. And of course, our media environment shifting played a big role in the civil rights movement, in its ability to gain visibility and success over time. And so the narrative that took hold on the hard right was simply that via cultural institutions, via educational institutions, via institutions of higher education, it was actually the Jews who were controlling and manipulating people of color, women, the gay liberation movement, trans people, etc., that all of our movements toward liberation were actually a Jewish plot. Because that's who they could see as the folks who had the capacity to actually achieve these things. I see you wanting to ask a question.
No, I'm mostly just nodding because my mind is blown. And I also want to make sure that we mention you said various degrees of explicitness, mm-hmm. and we've seen just in this last month, and for longer, I started hearing this a few years ago, but the kind of dog whistle of like George Soros paying protesters, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. he as a stand-in for the Jews, capital yes. T, as you said. And yeah, we've seen the horrible outcomes of that.
We have. And as a longtime student of this subject, I unfortunately can't say that I'm surprised. There has been a George Soros as a symbol for every era of anti-Semitism under the Nazis, and of course in our own country as well, in conspiratorial circles. It's been the Rothschilds.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's George Soros. And as soon as I saw the president talking about him, I knew that things were going to get much worse in this country. I knew it was going to happen quite quickly. I knew that it was not a coincidence that he was discussing Soros and his capacity to control social movements in the context of feminists standing up against the Kavanaugh nomination. All of these are really long-running patterns of anti-Semitism. And in fact, Soros, who's a Holocaust survivor, his efforts to promote democratic institutions abroad, especially in Ukraine, in Russia, in other parts of Eastern Europe, using his foundation, is something that anti-Semites abroad have long been having this conspiratorial dialogue about. And in fact, the Open Society University, which is an institution that he founded, just had to leave Hungary. They essentially fled Budapest for Vienna because they didn't feel it was safe to have their institution there anymore. So this is another example of the feedback loop, in fact, between the European far right and the American far right. These ideas about who he is and what he does with his money and how he uses it to control social movements, those didn't come up in America first. And they have, in fact, had horrible consequences for Jewish folks in those countries already. Jewish community centers that have received funding from the Open Society Foundation or that are rumored to have received that funding, and let's let that one sink in, mm-hmm. Are being forced to close their doors in Hungary. I don't think that's what we're necessarily facing in the next weeks and months. But again, I knew this was going to get a lot worse when the president mentioned Soros. And so I started talking with a lot of my friends about anti-Semitism. And I thought, all right, now is the time. If we just talk about these structural issues, if we seed this dialogue amongst our friends and families, you know, in 6 months or a year when something happens, we'll be ready.
Mm-hmm.
That was on October 8th.
Wow. Yeah. And I saw your post then, and it was really interesting.
Yeah.
Conversation to look at, because it's something I've struggled with in my own family and in different discussions of saying.
Totally.
And it's been hard for me because it's something we don't talk about to put my finger on why it's icky to
right.
say George Soros pays protesters.
Yes.
So thank you for
fleshing
that out.
A lot of people know that it's not good or even feel a sense of danger from it, but they can't tell you why. And another thing I learned from having those first discussions, actually, is that the prevalence of joking about Soros funding on the left. And I think we've all done this because I think we've all, or maybe not all of us, but I've definitely had this accusation thrown at me
mm-hmm.
For one thing or another, that I'm being paid by George Soros. And so, of course, our natural impulse is to make that sound silly and to mm-hmm. throw it back in their faces and say, ha ha, yes, Soros checks. You know,
yeah.
Clearly it's not my worldview and my deep conviction that like genocide is bad that's leading me to go out and challenge Nazis. Clearly, I'm just getting paid for this.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way that a lot of people will discuss it. And if this interview gets a little attention, I look forward to y'all cutting that piece out and making a little clip out of it.
Yeah.
But in any case, this is a very inappropriate joke to make.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that it shows, because it's context free, it stops us from using this as an educational moment for our communities, and it rips it out of context, and it makes light of something that's incredibly serious. So after I had those conversations, I stopped joking about George Soros, and I love to give people action items. So that's mm-hmm. your first one.
Good.
If you've done that, just stop.
Yeah, will do. And if you're just joining us toward the end of the show, you're listening to Praxis. I'm talking with Kate Bitz about white nationalism. Yeah, long, wide-ranging conversation. I wanted to mention other action items. I know that there is a, actually, I'll post a link if it's a public event to a vigil that's coming up on Tuesday. I don't know if it's, I'll post that link. Look for that in the podcast. If it is public, then I will share it.
Yep, so. I think that's a good call. Yeah. I think as far as learning how to take action against these kinds of things, it requires us to shift how we think about political action in general. Because there's a difference between how the state views left social movements versus right social mm-hmm. movements. I think this is a great time to talk a tiny bit about Bolsonaro's election.
Yes. I was hoping we would go there. So,
yes. And I will say that this is very fresh news for me. I've been extremely busy in the last days. So I'm just going to be very general about it because I don't know what has happened in the less than 24 hours since his election. I do know that some of his rhetoric has been very extreme. He's someone that I think goes far beyond what we've seen in this country mm-hmm. with Trump.
Yeah.
Far, far beyond mm-hmm. in terms of his explicitly yeah. violent aims toward yeah. the opposition.
And his record also of being part of a military dictatorship
yeah.
that was overthrown and now basically saying, like, we should have done more during the dictatorship.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just as a start
and,
with
right.
him.
And I mean, this is a perfect example of how we need to learn from history. If we don't talk about the repression and the horrible things that have happened in the past in our countries and in other places, that will be forgotten. And eventually it will be lionized. You know, we actually see this happening with the AfD, with Alternative for Germany in Germany as well right now. That's their far right party where some of their party leadership has described the Holocaust as just one tiny blot on a 2,000 year successful history and good history of Germany, and asking why they focus on it so much. That is the first step toward essentially what Bolsonaro has done
mm-hmm.
in Brazil.
So, yeah, just so we're on the role of the state,
yes,
you know, with him.
Exactly. So what we've seen with him is quite interesting in that the Wall Street Journal in this country, it wasn't explicitly an endorsement, but they talked about the positive side of his plans to open markets. The CBC has done the same thing. I think there's a really simple reason for that, and it's that right movements, they may challenge democracy, they may challenge our human rights. What they don't really challenge is capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a movement that's like unified across the color line to expand democracy, expand human rights, create better living conditions for all of us at the expense of capital.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that a lot of entrenched capitalist interests don't want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a pinch, in a time of instability like we have right now in 2018, capital will tend to side with the right.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen just how extreme that can get.
Yeah. And also just the state beyond capital. I mean, the two mm-hmm. aren't super extricable at this point. That's a whole nother conversation. But even just looking in the U.S. at responses to fascist and white nationalist gatherings and protests versus those counter protests and how police treatment has divided between those two groups.
Yeah,
that's pretty scary, too, because one group fundamentally supports authority and one group does not.
Yep. And I think that's a perfect object lesson in how we have to organize, because at this moment, we can't really count on the state to keep us safe. And we can't really count on things like our media institutions to keep us informed. You know, if I'm a Wall Street Journal reader, do I understand what Bolsonaro is bringing in terms of like an awful situation to many Brazilians? I mean, I've been misinformed mm-hmm. if I'm that reader. So we have a profound responsibility to each other on the left to stand in solidarity with one another across our various types of marginalization in these systems and across our various challenges, to stand up for one another and also to value ourselves, because this system doesn't. So if we take as our guideline the idea that we keep us safe, we includes you.
Mm-hmm.
It includes me. We're all important. And if we are all hopeless, if we're all burnt out, if we're all in prison, if we're all dead, there will be no one left to build that better world. We need to build ourselves up. We need to talk to each other about these issues when sometimes our media won't. We need to keep each other informed, keep each other happy and healthy, fed and housed and clothed and alive.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think a great first step toward that is to right now reach out to your friends, figure out how they're doing. If you're feeling awful yourself, reach out to, ask for what you need,
mm-hmm.
And find ways to come together in community this week and beyond.
Music to my ears, especially during election season, because yes, they're trying to seize power in the traditional way, and voting is important to protect that, and as a defensive maneuver at the very, very least.
Yep.
But man, this is a hard time of yes. year for me as someone whose politics are
exactly
a little
100% vote, because we need to
yes.
use every tool we have. I see voting for the best candidate that I can find to be a tiny pebble that I throw back.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're under attack, man, if that pebble's right there, throw it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But we also do need to ask ourselves, and I was hoping down on a hopeful note. However, so one of the things that Bolsonaro's election does show is that democracy is capable of voting itself out of power. So I was taught to always think about the worst case scenario actually as a way of diffusing anxiety. Imagine everything goes wrong. Imagine the Republicans win the midterms. I mean, don't let that stop you from turning in your ballot. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. Get those ballots in, people. But even if everything goes wrong, what will we be doing? And for me, that answer is I'm going to keep doing exactly what I have been doing. I'm going to keep monitoring these folks, finding organizing opportunities to expose them, educating my community, supporting my community on a very real level. And I know that I have friends who will probably listen to this, and if I haven't reached out to you yet, I love you and I want to hear from you wherever you're at this week. Yeah, it's So think about what you're doing. Think about whether it will be effective and helpful and good for you, no matter what the political environment is. And then agitate, educate, and organize. That's what we must do.
Great. Thank you so much for coming and talking with me. I feel like we could probably go for like 3 hours on this personally, but we can't. I will say that the Democracy Now! Episode that's coming up right now has some really great in-depth stuff following the Saturday attack in Philadelphia. There's a really good interview with Rabbi Ari Lev Fernari, who's a rabbi at a synagogue in West Philly, and David Glosser, who is super icky Stephen Miller's uncle and also has volunteered with HIAS, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. So, and then Glenn Greenwald talks about Bolsonaro. It's a great show. It's coming up. If you're just catching us at the end and you wish you heard the whole thing, I've been talking with Kate Bitz. I will post the podcast tonight. You can find the link at kyrs.org. You can also find Praxis on iTunes and Google Play, or you can just search for it directly at soundcloud.com/praxisradio, PRAXISRADIO. And you can always email me with show ideas and more at praxis@kyrs.org. So thanks so much again.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And yeah, hang in there. We'll be back next week.